Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.
Welcome to the Connecting the Dots podcast with Dr. Wilmer Leon, and I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Here's the point. We have a tendency to view current events as though they happen in a vacuum, failing to understand the historical context, the broader historic context in which these events occur. During each episode, my guests and I have probing, provocative, and in-depth discussions that connect the dots between current events and the broader historic context in which they occur. This enables you to better understand and analyze events that impact the global village in which we live. On today's episode, the issues before us are: what are the anticipated results of the most recent China-Russia meetings? Is the U.S. pivoting from Ukraine and Russia to China? And is the U.S. an independent actor in Haiti, as it claims? And we'll also discuss some other issues. My guest for this iteration of Connecting the Dots is a man who I am very proud to call a friend. His analysis is always spot on, and he's really just cool people. He's an author, two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, a Knight Fellowship recipient with more than 20 years of journalistic experience. He's a former Washington Post bureau chief and award-winning foreign correspondent on two continents, John Jeter. John, my brother, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, brother. Thank you. That's an outstanding introduction. I really appreciate it.
Well, I know my check's on its way, so I'll sit by the mailbox. So earlier this week, the Global Times reported Chinese President Xi meets Russian Foreign Secretary Lavrov and reaffirms China's emphasis on partnership with Russia. And Chinese analysts said the meeting sends a strong signal that China will firmly develop its strategic partnership with Russia, despite pressure from the West, and that the China-Russia partnership continues to be key for the global strategic balance and the hope of promoting a multipolar world in which countries in the global South will have greater roles to play. John, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think this is a tectonic shift, and it's you know, we've been talking about this for quite a while on your show. It's like a tanker, and of course it takes a while for that tanker to move, but it is moving, it is in motion. We see that geopolitical shift from the West, as the United States, as France, as the UK gets increasingly desperate, as they grow increasingly out of favor with what they're doing in Gaza and backing Israel's genocide. And we see this is a victory lap for Russia, right? What they've done in Ukraine, it's all over but the shouting, if I can use a phrase from my Southern cousins. And this is, you know, from what I understand, it's very rare for the president of China or any other country to entertain the foreign secretary. Usually it's foreign secretary or foreign secretary.
Peer to peer.
So this is a big deal. Again, it's like a tanker moving. It takes a while. And if I can sort of mix metaphors, it's like Lenin said, history moves in spiral. So this thing is not just sort of a linear thing, but it's just kind of moving in a certain direction. And we see Russia and China starting to sort of take charge, starting to ascend, very much like the United States did almost exactly a century ago after World War I. We're seeing China and Russia start to make their rise as this geopolitical force, the geopolitical almost like a ruling party, right, for the global elite. And it's almost inevitable. It's almost inexorable at this point. The only real question is, how will the United States respond? It can sort of, you know, go kicking and screaming, or it can negotiate sort of its descension into second place. So we'll see what happens. I think history says, of course, it will go kicking and screaming, but hopefully cooler heads will prevail at some point. And we'll see what happens. But this thing is going in a very definite direction. I don't think it's at this point, I don't think you can put the genie back in the bottle. And I think China and Russia sort of see the future and it's theirs.
I think people really need to pay attention to the next statement that I'm going to read, because the Western narrative of this is militarism. The focus of the West as it relates to this rising partnership is militarism. But Li Haidong, a professor at the Chinese Foreign Affairs University, said, quote, China and Russia will not target any third party, but if hegemonic forces threaten China and Russia or threaten world peace, China and Russia will stand together and fight to protect their own interests and safeguard world peace together. And I want to reiterate, they will not target any third party. So I take this as they're saying, don't start nothing, won't be
none.
We're going to handle our business.
I think so. I don't know if you've ever seen Oliver Stone's History of the World, or was it History of the World or History of the United States? I can't remember, but he talks at length about the relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States. And the Soviet Union, despite the sort of depictions by Reagan and other presidents of the Soviet Union as this sort of aggressively hostile, evil empire that wanted to take control of the world, the Soviet Union was really just terrified of the United States. They thought that the United States was insane, mm-hmm. that it was run by madmen. I think that still very much holds true. I think Putin understands that his heir, if he made any, his heir was entrusting the United States to some extent, and hoping, I think, that he could sort of find some common ground with the United States. I think he sees now that that is not possible. Although he said, interestingly enough, he said apparently in a speech some time ago, I heard someone else say this, I think it was Ray McGovern, former CIA operative, who said that Putin said...
CIA analyst.
Yes, analyst, I'm sorry. He said in a speech recently that Putin had once said, or very recently said, that the United States and Russia at some point will find common ground, but the EU and Russia will never find common ground. I think that's very interesting. But I think there's a I don't think the Putin, I don't think he's ever read Maya Angelou when she wrote, you know, when someone tells you who they are, believe them.
Believe them.
I think he believes them now, right? I think he believes the United States. And so we see this alignment where, you know, China and Russia, and this is their shock and awe moment, really, right? We're not looking for the smoke, but we're here for it. You know, if you got some for us, I think this is a very direct message at Washington, at France. You know, this thing in Ukraine is over, right? I mean, it's all over. But the shouting again, there's some loose ends to wrap up, including this terrorist attack that was very likely staged by Ukraine in Russia a few weeks ago.
Right.
So there's some loose ends to wrap up, but this thing is all over. And I think the Russia and China are now turning to the next phase, which is, you know, this inevitable rise to the top of the geopolitical order. Again, it's not a linear thing, right? It takes some time. We see them sort of orchestrating BRICS, and BRICS has not really been the dynamo that we expected. But what we see is that it's coming, though. And we also see that there are other countries, particularly in Africa, particularly in Latin America, with Mexico and Venezuela has been there for a while, but we see countries sort of mimicking BRICS, parroting BRICS in terms of, you know, Zimbabwe is talking about a gold-backed currency. And we see, of course, what South Africa is doing, which is sort of defining itself outside the U.S. orbit, the Western orbit. So we see some things that are in motion, and Russia and China are at the center. And the United States and the West, the collective West, is increasingly being pushed to the outer margins.
Well, and I'm going to stay with that pushed. Let me just say, because I'm glad you brought up BRICS, because people have to understand that this isn't just China and Russia. This is China and Russia and then the BRICS. And the BRICS is an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And right. then you have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There are a number of countries that are, Venezuela, Iran, there are a number of countries that are looking to join this group as well. And I'm glad you used the point that the United States is going to be pushed to the margins, because what a lot of people really, particularly in the West, really have to pay attention to is the fact that it's the sanctions regime of the United States. It's the threat of militarism by the United States. It's the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline by the United States that has really forced this relationship to develop and to grow, and now to become to the part where you've got Xi and Lavrov meeting for what will eventually be a meeting and a signing of documents between Xi and Putin. It's the United States' fault that they have come to the point that they have, John Xi.
Yes, you know, no, that's exactly right. And a couple of things I think we it would be important to note. One is that Janet Yellen was just in China.
Correct.
And compare her meeting with, I don't know if she met with Xi or not, but she met with, I know she met with their finance people.
She met with the finance people, and I think she met with Wang Li, the foreign minister.
Yes. And so her message was, you're overproducing and it's hurting us, right? Which is foolish. And I'm being generous by saying that it's foolish. That's a foolish message. I mean, it's almost like Rip Van Winkle waking up after 50 years saying, you're overproducing too much. It's hurting us. Like, well, what did you think was going to happen? And what, you know, I mean, do you not understand how this capitalist system works? So you compare that.
Wait a minute. And also, I thought that the United States was all about free markets.
Right. Exactly.
I thought the market was supposed to determine what succedes and what fails. The invisible hand and all this.
Yeah. Janet Yellen's a socialist. Who knew? Right. I think that's amazing, though, that we see this desperation.
She was begging.
Yes. And there's no, as I said this before, but I keep returning to it. It's amazing how this self-adoration and self-worship by the United States doesn't lead to self-awareness, right? How this looks like to the rest of the world. The other thing too, I think this is a perfect segue. It is what the rest of the world is starting to see. And you might argue that it's late even for that to happen, for them to see what's happening. But at least they are starting now to see that this world that was defined by the United States with neoliberalism, beginning with Ronald Reagan, really pushed by Bill Clinton, this whole, you know, neoliberal idea has failed. The idea was that if you do these things to open up your markets, right, to us, right?
Right.
You will look like the United States one day, right? You will be as rich and prosperous as we are. That hasn't happened anywhere, not even in the United States, right? It has not happened anywhere. No one looks like the United States. In some ways, that's very good, right? And so the world is seeing that this was a snake oil, right? Mm-hmm. Being sold by the snake oil salesman. And so we're at this pivotal point, and this is, it's very much like what did Mike Tyson used to say? Everybody has a plan until you get smacked in the nose.
Get punched in the face.
Yeah. The United States has been smacked in the nose in Ukraine. And let me end with this. And the other thing, in terms of it not working, and everyone else sees this, everyone else in the world, especially China and Russia. The United States, we have stolen money. We've stolen oil from Syria. We are in Iraq, and they have, the parliament, I think, has at least two times told the United States, ordered the United States to leave Iraq, and we're still there, right? Like the guest from Hurricane Katrina, who never want to leave. You know, that's what the United States is there in Iraq. And now, you know, we've stolen money from Afghanistan, stolen money. We've stolen money from Venezuela, and now we're about to steal money, the international reserves from Russia. And so this is going to destroy the United States as a reliable or trusted partner in any kind of commercial transaction. If they're just going to steal money, no one's going to trust them. So they're really in a very difficult spot. The rest of the world sees what's happening. The United States has no idea, or at least the American people don't. I think our leadership knows, but they have no way out.
So to your point about stealing money, for those that may not understand what you're referring to, many people remember the United States froze Iranian assets, right? And was slowly returning some of those assets to Iran. Then the United States, when Juan Guaido was forced on the Venezuelan people in the world, then the United States froze Venezuelan assets that I think were held in British banks. And now the United States is talking about freezing some of the Russian sovereign wealth fund that is being held in banks around the world. But the interesting thing is a lot of those banks are telling the United States, that's not a good idea. Don't drag us into this, because we don't want to have to deal with the repercussions of what Russia will do to us we steal their money. So, and I think some of that perspective is coming from the reality that the United States is not the only game in town anymore.
That's right.
Debo, if we go back to the movie Fridays, you know, Debo got hit with a brick.
And, he got knocked. He got knocked the F out.
Laying out on Craig's front lawn. So this is, man, this thing is unraveling. It is unraveling quickly. And folks really need to pay attention. President Xi said, China and Russia have embarked upon a new path of harmonious coexistence and win-win cooperation between major countries and neighbors, which has benefited the two countries and their peoples and contributed wisdom and strength to international fairness and justice. A couple of things in that statement. One, win-win cooperation. A lot of people need to understand that win-win is not just some euphemism thrown around carelessly. Win-win is an actual international cooperation strategy that Russia tries to reach with the countries it does business with. They don't go in and overthrow your government. They don't come in and tell you how to run your country. You have resources. They have money. They want to buy your resources at relatively fair market value. And they want you to be happy and they'll be happy. And that's how they do business. And they contribute wisdom and strength to international fairness and justice. That's not just rhetoric that they hide behind as some kind of excuse for overthrowing your government. People need to listen to Xi. People need to listen to Putin, because you listen to what they say, and then you look at what they do, and those things seem to be simpatico. John.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I just think, you know, as someone who considers himself a Pan-Africanist, I think this is a very exciting time. It's not written in stone yet, but there's a very real opportunity, I think, for we see things happening in Africa now. Some bad things with the militarization of Africa by AFRICOM in the United States, but we also see in some ways that has backfired, right? So we see this militarization has resulted in these coups by soldiers who have been trained by the United States, but who are representative of their people, particularly in Burkina Faso with this young man, Traore. We see Africa turning more toward Russia, which is actually where it was during the Cold War, but we see it turning back towards Russia. Finding these
Where is Patrice Lumumba University?
Right,
exactly. It's in Moscow.
That's right. And the Chinese, I I don't think it's a thing where African countries can sort of just lay back and be passive and say, oh, you know, China's going to save us. And I think they know this, right? I think China has cut a better deal than the United States, but one that so far has not necessarily been favorable and has led to economic development, which is what Africa most needs, is economic development, their own industrial sector at this point, one that is more environmentally sustainable, but they need their own industrial sector. They need, you know, they grow coffee, but they don't actually roast the coffee. Things like this is what they need. But I do think this.
Wait a minute, to that point, that's a brilliant point. People need to understand that we all know that the continent of Africa is the repository of minerals, and but in most instances, they don't process the minerals from raw form, raw ore, for example, into a marketable commodity.
Value added.
In fact, I think it was either Ghana or Guyana that makes cocoa beans.
Ghana, I believe it's Ghana.
So Ghana had been selling the unprocessed cocoa beans to Switzerland. And Ghana decided, we're going to start processing our own cocoa bean into cocoa powder domestically. Switzerland said, well, then we won't buy your product.
Right.
China
right.
said, we'll buy it. Right. You process it in-house, we'll buy it.
That's what I'm talking about. Yes. Yes, that's a very different relationship. That's one where there's an opportunity to grow to, because these value-added industries are where the money is, right?
Correct.
They raise wages for people. I'll tell a very quick story about my time in South Africa about 25 years ago when I was a young man, and I had a girlfriend at the time, and I was famously cheap. I'm still famously cheap, although I'm also broke. But I thought, I'm going to South Africa, so I'll buy some gold, and they have diamonds here, so I'll buy her a nice tennis bracelet, I thought, thinking it would be cheaper there. Actually turned out it costs more there, because while they mine the gold and the diamonds in South Africa, they have to send it all the way to Antwerp to get it cut, and then send it back to South Africa. And that's where the money is. So this is what I think can happen if Africa, they have to be strategic. They have to cut better deals with China. But China, there's some daylight with China that did not exist with the United States or the West, where China is a better grade of capitalism, and they get very much like what China did with the United States, beginning with the Nixon administration, where China basically cut these deals. They knew what they were doing, right? And I don't know if they knew that they were playing into the United States racism, but, and I'm not saying that China is racist like the United States, but they cut this deal knowing that eventually it would lead to this industrialized economy, right? Africa can do the same thing with China's investments if they're strategic. You know, I don't think that China's going to offer it just, you know, off the top of their head, but they can negotiate these things. I think China is willing, a willing partner in this enterprise. So we're on the cusp of something, I think, that is transformative, not just for the United States, but for the world. And so, you know, it's exciting. At the same time, of course, it's sort of traumatizing to see what's going on in the world. But it's just What did Gramsci say? This is the interregnum. The old is dying and the new cannot be
has
born.
Has yet been born. Or cannot be born.
Cannot be born. Right. Yet.
Two things, and we'll move on to talking about what's happening in Haiti. And that is, I was listening to Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and his testimony before the Senate. And I don't remember the senator, but one of them asked him, can you tell us that you will support our move to break the ties, the supply chain with China? Because the Department of Defense, all of this rhetoric about China is our enemy and we hate China, the Department of Defense buys critical components from China for defense equipment, for drones, and it's not just as easy anymore as saying we're not going to get this stuff from China, because some of these things, China is the only place you can get them.
That's right.
On the one hand, we're standing here beating our chests about screaming at China, and at the same time, we're getting key military components from them. Oh, and by the way, Janet Yellen is there meeting with them about trade and finance. Why? Because they hold so much of our debt.
That's right. That's right.
And so those are elements. That's why I say, folks, you've got to connect these dots. And things don't happen in a vacuum. There's a much broader historical context in which these things are operating. But CNN and MSNBCIA and the Washington Post, they won't give you the context. That's one of the things that is so invaluable, I believe, about this show and guests like my good brother, John Jeter. Before we get to Haiti, one final point on this too, and that is there was a piece in the South China Morning Post. The United States leaves a mess in Ukraine and moves on to China, as the State Department. At the State Department, the Ukraine girl is out and the China guy is in.
Right.
From Washington's perspective, it was a right assessment. Whether that's good for Asia and world peace is a different matter. So basically what they're talking about is the United States has decided that Ukraine basically is lost, and they're now trying to pivot, going back to Barack Obama and the pivot towards Asia. They're trying to pivot away from Ukraine the same way they did in Afghanistan.
Right.
25 years of getting your hind parts whooped in Afghanistan. Then you cut and run. And was it ironic that you then start the fight of Ukraine? And in fact, in listening to Lloyd Austin, they said since 2014, the United States has spent $300 billion in Ukraine. And I know that's a low estimate, but it's the number they quoted during the hearings, $300 billion.
Well, what did Tupac say? You got money for wars, but can't feed the poor.
There you go. And what did Dr. King say? War is the enemy the poor.
That's right. That's
John
exactly
Jeter.
Right. Yeah, no, it's exactly right. You know, I was listening to Jeffrey Sachs the other day. I spent half my time just listening to these podcasts with people like Jeffrey Sachs, but he was on that show Rising, I think, and he was answering a question about his critics who said that he was a Putin apologist, and the anchor asked him, you know, what do you say to your critics? He said, I told you so. That's my answer. I told you so, right? Ukraine is wrecked, and the money they're trying to send over there now is not going to make any difference on the battlefield. This is war profiteering. This is how the United States makes its money now, right? We don't, and this is all. It's very seamless too. You won't hear it in the press, but it's very seamless. We began to ship our manufacturing sector overseas, beginning with China, in the 70s under Richard Nixon. In part to punish the radical black political movement that was the kryptonite to capital, very much like kryptonite. What kryptonite is to Superman? The radical black political movement was to our oligarchs, and so we started sending this.
Explain that for the audience.
Because what you'll see, and you'll see this actually cyclically going back to even radical Reconstruction, where this radical black political tradition, when it's allowed to express itself freely, has a way of galvanizing the people, or if you are Marxist or Marxist friendly, the working class. That's just what it is. And so, I've interviewed people like Bernadine Dorn, who was with the Weather Underground. She says, you know, she spent her first year as the head of Students for a Democratic Society going around to these white college camps and say, telling them the first thing you need to do is get in touch with the black college, the historically black college down the street. You need to get in touch with them, see what they're talking about, right? And so this is
That's part of what Du Bois was writing about in Reconstruction in America.
That's exactly right. That's exactly, it goes back to that Reconstruction. If you look at that era, right, a lot of things happened, but there was, in the Confederacy, in the former Confederate States, there was a interracial political party of some type in every Confederate state in the Union after the Civil War. They all had varying degrees of success, but they all redistributed wealth from the top to the working class. They had some success in doing that. And so it is that Black political voice, you know, that really has shaped, has modernized this country, especially when we look at the New Deal, we look at the Blacks who are allowed finally to join the labor unions, and together we fought. And of course, you know, I mean, honestly, whites just went back to being white after the after that battle was won, or after we were winning the battle, they started going back to being white in the 70s. That's what Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan were about.
Really. But wait a minute. Just take a step back there, because I think it's important for people to realize that post the abolition of enslavement, you had newly freed Africans that were actually joining forces with poor whites.
Oh, no question.
And the industrialists realized that's a force that we cannot allow to grow in this country. And they then started injecting the whole construct of race into that relationship to draw a wedge between the two. So when you say that in the 70s, whites went back to being white, I wanted to be sure that people understood where that mentality came from.
And just to be clear, if you understand sort of, if, you know, people who are of a certain age will remember in the 70s when we start to see these movies. I love Paul Newman, but he was in that movie. What was it? Fort Apache, the Bronx. These movies and these television shows would start to show basically Blacks as unfit for public office, or Blacks as unfit for public to participate in public affairs. That's what mm-hmm. it was, right? Mm-hmm. So we're criminals, we're drug dealers, we're unpatriotic. Just as one example, if you remember the movie Alien from 1980, the most dangerous thing in that movie, other than the monster that had crept on board, was Yaphet Kotto, who didn't want, who was just concerned about his pay, right? Mm-hmm. So this image is what has shaped modern politics, the Black as unpatriotic, as unfit to lead, as unfit to participate, right? And so this is what we're really dealing with at bottom. This is why there's never been a socialist movement or working class movement in the United States the way there's been even in Europe. So
and that point could take us into a eugenics conversation. Yes, Dr. Chantella Sherman, I'm going to give you your props here and now. In fact, I got to get Dr. Chantella Sherman on, because you're talking about the way that we were misrepresented in these films. That's also been a history of eugenics supporting the whole argument that scientifically, that biologically, we are incapable
yes.
of managing and blah blah blah, because our brains are too small, our heads are too big, and right. you know, all that. Right. So anyway, right. again, connecting the dots,
yes.
folks.
Yes.
This is why you watch this show. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
So I was just saying, I think, you know, the understanding these connections, right, are what really helps us find a way forward. I don't know, honestly, if Black and white can unite and fight in the United States at this point. But I do believe that, as Fred Hampton said, you know, we can achieve Black power for Black people, white power for white people, yellow power for yellow people, and X power for all the people we left out. I do think that's possible, right, if we can start to sort of eradicate this tribalism, or at least put it aside long enough to work together and understand that, you know, we're at war in Ukraine not because Putin is trying to
take over Europe.
There's no history of that, right? Either the Soviet Union or for Putin. This is about the Wall Street profiteering. They don't have any way to make money because they shipped all the jobs overseas. They killed the goose that laid the golden egg. And now they're trying to make money. That's what, you know, I'm just looking at a television ad. I was watching an NBA game. They had an ad about gambling, you know, and gambling is legal everywhere now, right? Why is that? We're like Cuba was in 1958, right? It's because they can't make money any other way other than gambling through these, you know, Uber, which is basically just rent seeking, what the French call rent seeking, looking to profit off something that already exists. This is how they make money. And war is part of that. So you really do have to connect the dots. Your show is aptly named. You really do have to connect the dots historically and contemporaneously to understand what's going on, because that's the only way you can actually work your way out of this, as my father would say, my late father would have said, this trick bag that we find ourselves in.
And the new Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, to your point about profiteering, quote, "I would argue that working closely with other nations, not just diplomatically, but in defense avenues, has the consequence of strengthening peace and stability more generally," end quote. So what he's saying is dumping more military hardware into already very tense situations and making them more volatile somehow is going to strengthen peace and stability, or as Orwell said, in terms of doublespeak, war is peace.
Right. I think Obama said the same thing, did he not?
Yes, he did. War is
peace, basically, which tells you a lot about Obama and why he was put in that place, why he was installed. It says a lot about Obama and this country.
So let's quickly move to Haiti, because there's been a lot happening over the last, a lot of negative things happening for Haitians in Haiti. The Washington Post, of all places, had a piece, "When Haiti's gangs shop for guns, the United States is their store." Now, there's a lot of crap and a lot of garbage in this piece, because again, it is the Washington Post. But
my former employer, I should add.
There you go. So, am I wrong?
Not at all.
Okay.
So
heavily, this is the Washington Post. "Heavily armed gangs control 80% of Port-au-Prince, according to a UN estimate, where they rape, kidnap, and kill with impunity. Haiti doesn't manufacture firearms, and the UN prohibits importing them, but that's no problem for the criminals. When they go shopping, the U.S. is their gun store." And what there is so much context and so much reality that is omitted from this piece. For example, Haiti doesn't manufacture weapons, but that's no problem for the criminals, because the elite in Haiti that control the ports allow the weapons into the country. John Jeter.
Yeah, and I even take issue with that phrasing, the criminals. Who exactly are the criminals?
Right? That's my point. That's why I mentioned the elite.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with Haiti, people think, you know, it's just these sort of animalistic Haitians who are always fighting, and you know, this guy named Barbecue is just this crazed, maniacal, you know,
cannibal.
Haitian, yeah, cannibal, right.
They were talking about him eating people last week.
Yeah, but you know, if you ask the Haitian people, right, I mean, really, mm-hmm. the Haitian people, right, not the elites, but the,
right.
they'll tell you, well, you know, if you really, everybody, of course, knows what happened with Haiti, you know, with Napoleon and then the debts and, you know, the United States going in 1915. But they'll tell you, people in Haiti will tell you, well, you know, you can trace this back to when they got rid of Jean Bertrand Aristide, the
Correct.
Democratic elected president, who is, I think, well, still.
Wait a minute. You said they. Who was the they?
Oh, the United States.
Thank you.
At gunpoint, went in and kidnapped him.
Yeah,
kidnapped him. And then would not, Obama did this, first black president, my president is black, would not allow him back in the country to run for president, but would let Baby Doc back in to run for president, right? And then, you know, part of the reason was, and you know, they've got all these sort of arrangements, sweatshops there. They're taking land that can be used for agriculture.
Your Levi jeans are probably made in Haiti.
Baseballs are made in Haiti. And this is a company apparently that Hillary Clinton fought to keep the wages low, to make these baseball. I can't even watch baseball anymore, knowing that, right? And so, you know, we've always
hang on a second, because you talk about the wages. So let me make this point. So I don't forget it. So they talk about the arms that are trafficked, however you say it, to Haiti are purchased by straw purchasers in states such as Florida, right? Mm-hmm. A 50 caliber sniper rifle that sells for $10,000 in the U.S. can get as much as $80,000 in Haiti. A 50 caliber sniper rifle that sells for $10,000 in the U.S. can fetch $80,000 in Haiti. What is the average annual gross income, per capita income for a Haitian?
I don't think it's $8,000. I don't think it's one-tenth of that.
It's $1,000 as of 2022, which is the last time the data was collected. $1,247.89, which averages $3.42 per day. So how is somebody who makes on average $3.42 per day going to buy an $80,000 50 caliber sniper rifle?
Right, right. Who's buying these weapons?
Thank you,
Who's
John.
Who's buying these weapons? Right, right. The job of the media today is to, and it's always been this way, but now it's worse than ever. The job is to decontextualize the news. Right, it's to disconnect it from the history. That's why you get this sort of constant barrage of, well, the economy's doing great. I don't know why people are so upset, because they're broke, fool. That's
and
why
nobody
people are upset.
To the position of decontextualization. So you see these pictures, or you see this footage of these Haitian young men roaming the streets with AR-15s, AK-47s, 40 caliber Berettas, which will run you close to a 40 caliber Beretta, depending on a model, will run you say between $700 and a grand. And nobody asks the question, where'd that kid get that pistol from?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
He's making $3.42 a day, $1,200 a year, and he's walking around with, and we aren't even talking about putting bullets in the thing.
Right.
Nobody's asking that question.
Yeah, well, we are, right? But the media doesn't want to ask because the answer is very uncomfortable. The answer is very discomforting.
It's the core group. They're called the core group.
That's right. That's right.
They're called Montana group.
Like, was it six families that run Haiti, basically?
Right.
None of them black, by the way. None of them black. I think they're Lebanese and something else.
Now,
like
that I'm not sure of.
They're not black.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe some of them are, but not most of them are not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So folks, you've got to understand the context here. I can't remember the guy's name, but the United States has just appointed a new ambassador to Haiti. But here's the trick bag, if I can quote the late Mr. Jeter. In order for an ambassador to be recognized, he or she has to present his or her credentials to the president of the country that he's going to.
I hadn't.
There's no president.
How does that work? Right.
So how does an American ambassador land on the ground in Port-au-Prince? Who does he turn to?
Yeah,
Jimmy Cherizier.
Barbecue? Right.
Who does he turn to? There's nobody home. But again, I didn't hear Rachel Maddow asking that question.
Right.
I didn't hear Joy Reid asking that question. And folks, you can look. You can look in the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, where they describe the responsibilities of the president. One of the responsibilities of the American president is to what? Recognize ambassadors from other countries. That's how the international diplomatic game is played.
Right.
The American ambassador to China presents his or her credentials to Xi Jinping, and Xi Jinping goes, okay. Or get out of my country.
I don't think so. Right, right, right.
Homie, don't play that.
Right. And on another note, I related, but not quite at the point, but I just think this is so interesting. I was reading a recent piece, I cannot remember where, but they were talking about the origins of Haiti's gangs. And if you read it, right, they didn't mention this, but I know the history. Mm-hmm. It's the same as the gangs in Chicago, Los Angeles. They were formed to protect the community from the police, right? Mm-hmm. From harassment.
The Black Panthers.
Self-defense. That's exactly right, right? And you know, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale got to start getting a traffic signal in a particularly dangerous stop in Oakland. So this was the order. Now, I'm not saying that they're still necessarily representing the people, but that's how they got their start. They filled this void that was left by the state, because the state was just serving the interests of rich people and the United States and the West, Canada and France and all that. So, I just wish people would sort of, we're such a dumbed down nation. I don't mean that to be judgmental, but it's just the case.
What was one of the major actions that the Panthers in Oakland performed every day on the street? They were policing the police.
That's right.
So when they came across cops in a traffic stop, they would pull over, mm-hmm. locked and loaded.
Right.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't have a round in the chamber. But they were armed.
Yeah.
And they would stop and be sure that the traffic stop was proper, and that the person being pulled over, usually the African-American driver of the car, was not going to be. In fact, folks need to understand what was the Mulford Act in California. The Mulford Act was the law that was passed in California, I want to say 71, 72. When the Panthers went into the California
State House,
mm-hmm. armed, legally armed, so long as you didn't have one in the chamber, legally armed, and the folks in California said, "Oh no, we can't have this anymore."
Gun control.
That's why I've been saying for years: if you want gun control in the United States, let the government see law-abiding Black people legally buying and training with firearms, you will find gun control, as they would say, lickety split.
It is gun control in the United States is very similar to our edict that Iran can't possess nuclear weapons. Why can't they? They're a sovereign country, right? Because we don't want them to defend themselves. That's why. Just like we don't want Black people to defend themselves. We've got this plague of Black people being shot by the police, and we don't want Black people to be able to shoot back.
And quiet as is kept, Iran is a signatory to the nuclear non-proliferation agreement.
I read the Ayatollah.
Israel is not.
Israel, and they got, I think, something like 300, 400 nuclear warheads. Right. Iran doesn't even want nuclear weapons. They want nuclear energy. They've said that. They had a fatwa that banned from the Ayatollah banned nuclear. So you know, but on the news here, including one of my former colleagues at the Washington Post, Gene, I can't remember his name now, but he says, well, of course, Iran wants nuclear weapons. Really? So do you know something that the intelligence agencies of the United States don't know? Because they say that there's no such nuclear weapons program by Iran.
There isn't, and they don't need one because of the missile technology, hypersonic missile technology that they have developed. And also, they don't want a nuclear weapon because they understand the attention that brings to them, and it's negative. They don't want none of that smoke.
Right.
Because also their military perspective is defensive, not offensive.
Right.
So
very much like the Soviet Union. Very much like the Soviet Union.
That's why Ukraine is being turned into rubble.
Right. That's exactly right.
Is because Russia has been planning for 25 years for this very type of ground ballistic missile, ground or artillery driven ground war of attrition. I will just send missiles into your bathroom all day, every day for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And eventually you'll call and ask me, will you please stop sending missiles into my bathroom?
I don't know much about militarism and war strategy and things like that, but I've been reading up a little bit on Russia. And what I've concluded is you don't want nothing to do with Russia. You don't want no smoke from Russia.
When the United States sent, I think it was USS Eisenhower into the Mediterranean about 3 or 4 months ago. No, it was in October, in response to October 7th.
Oh, right. That's right. I remember that.
Biden sent, I think it was the Eisenhower aircraft carrier group into the Mediterranean, and Putin called Biden and said, Joe, why did you send that aircraft carrier group into the Mediterranean? He says, you're not scaring anybody. Because he said, these people don't scare.
Right.
Oh, by the way, I can sink your aircraft carrier from here.
Right.
With our SU-35 fighter jets with hypersonic Kinjal missiles. Right. I can sink the thing before you even know the missile has been fired.
Joe, what are you doing? Yeah, we started, you know, by talking about Mike Tyson's theory about, you know, everybody's got a plan. I think it's appropriate to mention, you know, just like Mike Tyson, you know, he beat all these people, all these other boxers because they were afraid of him until he met Buster Douglas.
And Buster Douglas
was not afraid. He did not back up. He kept coming. and we know that. And I don't want no smoke from Mike Tyson, but Buster Douglas was ready for him. And so, yeah, this is the United States now. We're Mike Tyson, but we're in the ring now with Buster Douglas. Putin is not afraid, right?
And see, and to your Mike Tyson analogy, the thing that Mike Tyson was always susceptible to was a jab.
Right.
The problem was he didn't come across an opponent that was big enough in stature that had the jab until he fought Buster Douglas.
That's right.
What's his name from Eastern Pennsylvania, the heavyweight?
Larry Holmes
would have wiped the floor. Larry Holmes had a jab.
Oh, I remember Larry Holmes. Yeah, I know he was a bad man.
I didn't mean to turn this into a boxing conversation, but just for the point, Larry Holmes's problem was he came in the shadow of Ali. But you go back and look at footage of Larry Holmes in his day, man, that brother, he would have wiped the floor because that's the, and I go through all of that here. I'm gonna connect the dots you have to understand the weakness of your opponent and exploit that weakness. And that's what Russia does. That's what Iran does. That's why President Raisi of Iran, in response to the Syrian bombing of the embassy in Syria, he said, we will respond when we are ready. The United States intelligence services told us last week, expect a response within 48 hours from Iran. I said, no, we'll get to it when we're ready. And what has Israel already done? Closed 30 embassies around the world.
Right.
So in Iran's mind, we've already won. You've closed 30 embassies. We didn't have to strike one of them. We scurred you into action.
And from what I understand, again, I'm new to this sort of military strategy, but from what I've understood, that the weakness of the United States is this overconfidence, this arrogance.
Yes.
That beginning, I think, with was it North Korea and China, when they lured them in, the United States lured them in and basically they just trapped. They knew they would come. They knew, because they're so arrogant. They knew they would take the bait. And that's the Achilles heel of the United States, is their overconfidence.
And that's what Iran isn't doing. They're not taking the bait.
Right.
Russia did not take the bait as they went into Ukraine, but they went into Ukraine not in the manner in which the United States thought they would. They didn't take the bait. China, as it relates to Taiwan, they're not taking the bait. They, hence the adage, you have the watches, but right. we have the time.
That's right. That's
right. We'll handle this our way when we're ready. Look at what's going on right now in Gaza. You've got Hamas, right? Hezbollah hasn't really jumped in like everybody thought they would, right? You've got the Houthis, Ansar Allah in Yemen. They're handling the Red Sea, but they aren't really in it. Not everybody's in the pool yet. And see, this is something that folks really need to understand is they are biding their time. All of those entities are sitting back watching the show. And there's a reason that Hezbollah hasn't jumped in. Because Hamas is winning.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of all the podcasts. The one that I watch the most is Ali Abunama with the Electronic Intifada. And from everything I'm getting from there, they seem to really know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Hamas is handling his business.
When I say Hamas is winning, folks could look at this and scratch their head and say, Wilmer, have you seen Gaza lately?
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Hamas wins by not losing.
Right.
When they live to fight another day, they win. Israel comes into Gaza. What is Israel saying now? We're getting out of Gaza. They come in, they get thumped, they get out.
Yeah.
When the dust settles, Hamas will still be in existence. And by being in existence, they will have won.
That's right. And I think this was all very calculated by Hamas. I'm not sure if they even understood this kind of blowback, but they were trying to pull Israel into this war because they knew what Israel would do.
Right. I'm glad you brought this up because when you talk about that, I was trying to get that together in my head. And that was a point that I was trying to make was that Hamas lured IDF into they strategy. Knew what their response would be. Because of their arrogance.
Right.
And they are thumping them.
Yeah. And there's no way out. This is, I can't repeat the lyric I want to. I think it was Ice Cube said, I don't want to hear that. I ain't mean it, right? That's what Hamas is saying to Israel right now. You know, right. I don't hear none of that. I ain't mean it, right? I don't gloat for anyone's death, and what's happening there is horrific, and I'm not sure if it's worth the cost. It's a Pyrrhic victory if it is one for Hamas, but you know this is the way it's going to end. You know, Israel is not going to exist as we have long known it, if I can coin a phrase from Bill Clinton.
And let's wrap up with this. The Nation magazine reports more than 500,000 Democratic voters have told Biden save Gaza. The campaign to use uncommitted primary votes to send a message to Biden has won 24 delegates, more than 500,000 Americans in states across this country have cast Democratic primary votes for either uncommitted, uninstructed, or no preference.
That's right.
I think the Democrats are shaking in their diapers.
It's a wrap for the Democrats, certainly for the Biden administration. And of those 500,000 votes, I believe 100,000 are in Michigan. Joe Biden can't win Michigan. Joe Biden does not win re-election.
And Joe Biden only won Michigan by about 130,000 votes.
That's right. Yeah, he can't. If the vote was today, he would not win Michigan. Not because everybody will vote for Trump, but because a lot of people stay home. And Michigan, let me just say this very quickly. Michigan and the Arab community, and DeBoer, I lived in Detroit for a couple of years in the early 90s.
Okay.
They are really impressed with terms of their organization. And they're showing us, they're giving us a roadmap for how we can fight back as a people.
Exactly.
Organize.
And I've listened to a number of interviews from Arab Americans in Michigan. And the reporters will say, well, don't you realize that your uncommitted movement could wind up resulting in the election, the re-election of Donald Trump? And they look in the camera and say, we know, and we don't care about that. We have a bigger point than Donald Trump that we are conveying. We don't. And plus they realize, you know, is it a blue car or a green car? It's still a car. You're gonna wind up basically in for the most part in the same circumstance, because it's not to a great degree, and you are much more adept at this than I am. To a great degree, it's not Trump policy, it's not Biden policy, it's American foreign policy.
That's right.
Irrespective of who the president is, John G.
Yeah, no, and I just don't think they understand. What part of genocide don't you understand? I'm not voting for a genocider.
Well, if you ask Lloyd Austin, he doesn't understand it at all, because he said during the Senate hearings, there's no genocide in Gaza.
If it looks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck,
and it dies like a duck, it's genocide.
Right, that's a genocide, man. You know, it just is a thing. You're a lawyer, so what is the lawyer?
No, I went to law school. I went to law school. I'm not a lawyer.
Okay. I didn't mean to defame you like that.
Well, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. So what you got?
So what is it? Low ipso requitur? Is it the thing is as it appears? It is as it looks.
You just combine two phrases, res ipsa loquitur.
Okay, thank you. I didn't even go to law school, and I didn't stay at Holiday Inn Express. So
res ipsa loquitur, I think is the Latin you were going for.
Yes, right. The thing is as it appears, right? It is as it looks. Yeah, that's a genocide. It's the most horrific thing I've seen in my lifetime, and there's just nothing else to say. I don't know how anyone's going to pull the lever for Joe Biden, seeing the horror that's happening in Gaza. It's heartless, traumatized. So I don't think there's a path for victory. I didn't think there's a path to victory for Joe Biden before October 7th. I certainly don't think there's one now. And I still think people laugh at this. I know Joe Rogan said it, and I don't know that I believe very much in Joe Rogan's political acumen, but he said that he thinks that the Democrats are going to replace Biden in May. I don't know if they're going to do it. I don't know if they're going to do it in May, but I've been saying that
for a year and a half.
Yeah, I think they might. I think they're looking to. I'll say that. I think there's a faction of the Democratic Party that's looking to. I think a year and a half ago, they were actively looking at Michelle Obama. I know that, as a matter of fact. I don't think she's going to do it. I'm not sure if that's still a movement, but I think they're looking, because they know he can't win, and it's too important. It's money that they will lose if he's not president, because Trump, for all his flaws, is not the war profiteer that Obama was and that Biden is.
I've been saying for almost a year and a half that I don't think that when you come out of the Democratic convention in August, I think right now it's the 19th, but we just found out that Ohio has told the Democratic Party that if it's held on the 19th, Joe Biden can't be on the Ohio
I heard that. Yeah.
Because it has to be, you have to be the nominee 90 days before the election to be on the ticket in Ohio. Oh,
wow.
And so Ohio has told them. But anyway, I've been saying that I said almost a year and a half ago that when you come out of the convention, it's not going to be Biden. It's most likely going to be Gavin Newsom. And what's her name from Michigan? Gretchen Whitmer.
Oh.
And I said the top of that ticket could go either way.
That would be the best foot they could put forward if they can't get Michelle Obama. That would be. And I don't think they can beat Trump, I'll be honest. But
no, I'm not saying that's going to win. Yeah, I'm not saying that's going to win. But when you look at the numbers, and since I said this, Biden's numbers have only gotten worse.
Right.
So Gretchen Whitmer most likely brings the Democrats Michigan, because she's the governor of Michigan.
Right.
And because they're also, when you get rid of Biden, you got to get rid of Kamala Harris as well.
Oh yeah.
So then you're going to wind up with a bunch of angry women. And you're going to wind up with a bunch of angry black women.
Oh, that's good.
So Gretchen Whitmer brings the women back into the game. And I think, and I'll probably get bricks thrown at me for saying this, but I think a majority of Black women will fall in line with the Democratic Party. I seriously doubt that they would get so angry that they would abandon the party. I think they would be convinced to fall, because Kamala will be convinced to go away quietly and be a team. They'll offer her, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like they did with Al Gore. They'll offer her, you know, a bunch of money.
Yeah, or something. Or tell her, you know, this is not your time.
Dean of some university where she can go and, you know,
spot. They might make her, you know, ambassador to, I don't know, Botswana or
a place. The Botswanas might run her out into the sea, though.
That's why they'll send her there. So Gavin Newsom, young white cat, governor of California, looks good in a suit, is articulate, can raise money, can raise his own money. I'm not advocating this. I'm looking at the landscape and saying they have no arms in the bullpen.
I wouldn't bet against that. I wouldn't.
Since this is baseball season, they have no arms in the bullpen. So, but Biden is behind in like 7 of the 9 battleground states.
Yeah, he can't win. I think Pennsylvania's tied, but even that is
trending in the wrong direction.
Because in a lot of these states,
Donald Trump is now ahead outside the margin of error of the polling.
Right.
And growing. So, no, I've been saying that Joe Rogan and I agree on that. And I'm on record for a year and a half saying Joe Biden is, and I don't think they can do it in May, because the voters will cry foul at, then why did we have primaries? You haven't had any debates. So I think they have to make the switch at the convention. I think the vote has to go down to the floor, and it'll be the way it used to be when we were kids watching the conventions on television, where there was all of this tension and all of this anxiety over how were the votes going to go as they did the roll call for the states from the floor. I think it's got to go that way. I don't know how they make the switch now before the convention.
I know this, though. What they don't want, their worst nightmare, is for Joe Biden to appear on a debate stage with Donald Trump. They can't have that. They don't want that. That's just...
No.
Yeah.
No.
That can't happen.
No.
That can't
happen. You don't even want to see, and I mean this very seriously, you don't even want to see Joe Biden walk to the podium.
No, I agree.
Versus Donald Trump. Just the appearance of that stiff.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
No.
And you think about that. I mean, Donald Trump is a dinosaur, you know, but he still looks better than, he still is more commanding than Joe Biden. That's
right. Do you want a pterodactyl, or do you want to? Anyway, Mammy. So I want to thank my guest and my dear brother, John Jeter, for joining me today. And John, when I said that, you say?
Thank you, brother. It was wonderful to be here. Wonderful.
And folks, thank you all so much for listening to the Connecting the Dots podcast with me, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Stay tuned for new episodes every week. Also, please follow and subscribe. Leave a review, share the show, subscribe. Doing this every week is not cheap. Trust me, we need your help. Also, follow us on social media. You can find all the links below in the show description. Go to Patreon. Please contribute to the Patreon account. And remember, folks, that this is where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge, because talk without analysis is just chatter. And we do not chatter on Connecting the Dots. See you again next time. Until then, I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Have a great one. Peace. I'm out.
Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.